I am speaking on this occasion not as a member of Western democracy, but as a human being, a member of the species man, whose continued existence is in doubt.
What is it that man has created from two pieces of uranium? Is it a menacing cloud that threatens world destruction?
The atom has increased the world's insecurity. The United States, for the first time since the Indian Wars, has live frontiers vulnerable to assault.
Or is it a super sun that holds new promise for mankind?
The atomic age holds out hope of greater prosperity and better living than we had ever known before.
NBC News presents The Atom, Menace and Promise, a specially transcribed program to mark the 10th anniversary of atomic energy. The program will be presented by NBC newsmen who have followed the story of the nuclear age and have watched it develop into the thermonuclear age. In addition, there will be special statements by Lieutenant General Leslie R. Groves, Hanson W. Baldwin, and David O. Woodbury. To set the stage for our story, here from the NBC newsroom in New York is your editor-narrator, Arthur Whately.
The scientists know it as the critical mass in chain reaction, the atomic fireball that is hotter than the center of the sun itself. You and I know it for its terrible devastation in war, and by its now familiar pattern of a gigantic mushroom cloud. That cloud was last seen in warfare 10 years ago today, over the Japanese city of Nagasaki. Near the center of that atomic blast of a decade ago, there now stands a bronze statue with this inscription: "The 9th of August is Doomsday." To the Japanese, whose wanton attack on Pearl Harbor brought us into the Second World War, Doomsday came twice in that year of 1945, first on the 6th of August. An American B-29, the Enola Gay, had taken off from Tinian Island on a secret mission the night before. It was piloted by Paul W. Tibbetts, Jr., and the log of its mission was recorded for history by co-pilot Robert A. Lewis.
It is 7:30. Parsons has put the final touches on his assembly job. We are now loaded. The bomb is alive. We start to climb to our final altitude at 7:40. Won't be long now. We have now set the automatic pilot for the last time until bombs away. We are now ready for the final bomb run. It is 8:50. Not long now. There will be a short intermission now while we bomb our target.
Up until that time, the most of the other cities had been already bombed, and Hiroshima was safe. So, the people thought Hiroshima was the safest place in the world.
The Reverend Kiyoshi Tanimoto, American-educated Methodist minister of Hiroshima, a survivor of the A-bomb. Interviewed for NBC by Tex McCrary, he was asked about the attitude of the people in Hiroshima immediately after the blast.
The people felt a strong sense of guilty. They started war. And as a result of it, they got such an unprecedented disaster.
They felt the sense of guilt.
Yes.
Rather than a sense of hatred.
Yes. The way to Pearl Harbor led again Hiroshima disaster.
Can you remember the broadcast of your emperor?
Yes, we are told that a very important announcement will be made. I went up to the ruin of the Hiroshima railroad station and saw a big cloud. The sun was standing on the sticks, having a terrible scars in bandages and wept when they heard voice of emperor.
The wounded came and listened.
Yes.
And wept when they heard the voice of the emperor.
That's right.
Can you recall in Japanese what the emperor said to you that day?
Taiga taki wo taete bansei ni heiwa wo hirakan tame ni tatakai wo yameru to. We stop the war to open the way for the permanent peace for the world.
Permanent peace for the world. No, and not yet. But the bomb did hasten the end of the war with Japan. And on August 14th, just 5 days after Nagasaki, they accepted our terms of surrender. Terms that were formally signed on September 1st. And the war was ended. Today, a decade later, the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have memorials to the A-bomb dead, where they pray that such weapons never again be used. In Hiroshima, there's an arched white stone cenotaph to the dead with this inscription, "Rest ye in peace, for we shall never repeat the mistake." That mistake, they say today, was not made by any one country. It was a mistake made by humanity.
The Japanese people have been given ample opportunities in these 10 years to study, feel, and consider the human, scientific, and political aspects of the atomic power, and have today grown up to the stage where we want to take a positive role in the world towards peaceful use of the atomic power and against its use for human suffering.
The words of a Japanese girl 10 years after Hiroshima. In the same pattern, a boy who saw the awful devastation at Nagasaki.
I had a narrow escape from that deadly thing. I suffered all of 5 steps of A-bomb disease, what they call, and now have lived 10 years since. I give all my yes to Ike's proposal at the big table. If Ike's proposal will come true, we'll have new and quite different picture of mankind.
10 years ago today, the second and last atomic bomb ever used in warfare was dropped over Nagasaki, Japan. Since that day, the world has prayed with increasing fervor that there may never again be a need for such a bomb to be dropped as an act of war.
Lieutenant General Leslie R. Groves, who headed the Manhattan Project during the war, now Vice President of the Remington Rand Division of the Sperry Rand Corporation.
Those of us who were most intimately connected with the building of that bomb and the explosion of the bomb over Japan have perhaps more reason than any others to pray that it may never have to be used again. In a very real sense, the 3 bombs exploded in July and August of 1945, the first as a test explosion at Alamogordo, New Mexico, and the second and third against the Japanese, ushered in a new age. The world calls it the atomic age. I would not feel right about it if on this anniversary I did not say a few words about the Manhattan District. This was the organization which developed the theories behind the atomic bomb, both at Oak Ridge and at Hanford, Washington, also at Los Alamos, as well as our major laboratories at Columbia, Chicago, and Berkeley. Thousands of workers labored in order to make the bomb possible. The bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August of 1945 dramatically focused the attention of the people of the world upon an irrevocable fact. The atomic age was no longer a matter of wild, so-called Sunday supplement prophecies. It had begun. By all previous standards, it would be an age of extremes. It offers us, on one hand, more death, destruction, and suffering than the world has ever known. And on the other hand, it holds out hope of greater prosperity and better living than we had ever known before. Let me quote from some remarks of Sir Winston Churchill, who was Prime Minister of Great Britain, when the first atom bombs were exploded. In his book, Triumph and Tragedy, Churchill wrote, "There was never a moment's hesitation as to whether the atom bomb should be used or not. To avert a vast, indefinite butchery, to bring war to an end, to give peace to the world, to lay healing hands upon its tortured peoples by a manifestation of overwhelming power, seemed, after all our toils and perils a miracle of deliverance. I quote these words of the British Prime Minister because they represent in a real sense what we all thought. Now, as we come to assay the 10 years that have followed that decision, we must ask ourselves, how has it all come out? Did the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki open the doors to permanent peace by making war so terrible that no sane man would risk it? Or did it close the door to permanent peace and leave us in the uneasy position of a people who cannot afford to relax for an instant lest our enemies attack us? Probably no one today can answer that question, but at least we can all think about the question and try to untangle some of the basic factors involved in it. What are these factors? First, what is the role of the atom bomb today as a military weapon? I think we can all agree on one thing. We must not relax for a single instant in our preparation so that we will be able to use this weapon if we have to. Second, we must face the fact that all of us, civilians as well as soldiers, will be involved in any future war. I've made this point not for the purpose of frightening my listeners, but to awaken you into action. We can take certain steps that will mitigate against the likelihood of a knockout blow. But to do this, we must review not only our military, but our civilian ideas. We must regard our industrial organization and our military establishment as partners in this joint enterprise. This brings me to the third point, and this is what has generally been called atoms for peace. What will the world be like if we are able to stifle forever the terrible threat of total disaster and turn our eyes toward the peacetime uses of atomic energy? We started to plan for the use of nuclear power in peace almost as soon as we started to plan for its use in war. We have already made strides forward in its peacetime uses. We have made progress in medical science through the use of radioactive isotopes. We have made progress in industrial power and are making more progress. May I say, as a final word, both the menace and the promise of the atom go together. We must have the first to ensure the second. But in the long view, I believe the greatest value of this tremendous event in our history will be not the menace of the atom, but its promise of the greatest prosperity the world has ever known. In order to fulfill that promise, we must first be sure, however, that the other things that go with the promise are kept secure: our freedom to live and work as we choose, our great free enterprise system, the things that have made America great. Unless these things are part of the promise of future prosperity, nothing else that we accomplish will be worth anything.
Lieutenant General Leslie R. Groves, who headed the Manhattan Project that developed the first atomic chain reaction on December 2, 1942. For a few moments, let's go back to the first experiments, which were started late in 1939 after the atomic possibilities had been outlined in a letter to President Roosevelt by Professor Albert Einstein. The late physicist and mathematician had pointed out the energy and new type bomb possibilities in discoveries of two scientists, Enrico Fermi and Leo Szilard, and the atomic program was decided on after Hitler's legions began to roll in Europe.
The Manhattan Project was a war agency. Its achievement was a weapon of war.
To fill in the details of the story, let's call in an NBC newsman who followed the program from the start, Chet Huntley.
Beneath the football stands of Chicago University, December 2, 1942, Fermi proved his theory of a chain reaction. The cadmium tubes were removed one by one from the pile of graphite in which pellets of uranium were embedded. The cadmium tubes were the control valves. They absorbed the neutrons which otherwise would penetrate the nucleuses of the uranium atoms and split them in two. The Geiger counters began to chatter. The needles revealing the amount of radioactivity began to climb upward and upward, no tendency to level off. The chain reaction was underway. Dr. Arthur Compton placed a phone call to Dr. James Conant at Harvard. He was head of the section of Office of Scientific Research and Development. As Conant came on the phone, Compton said, "The Italian navigator," meaning Fermi, "has reached the New World." "And how did he find the natives?" asked Conant. "Very friendly," was the reply from the old squash court beneath the deserted bleachers of Stagg Field at the University of Chicago. But even before the final test in the squash court, Fermi and his associates had convinced the government that the energy released from the splitting of the uranium atom could could be controlled to make of it a powerful weapon. Thus, on August 13, 1942, the Manhattan District had been created. Already, General Groves had arranged for the DuPont Company to produce plutonium at Hanford, Washington. The separation of very fissionable from less fissionable uranium would be done at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And if the bomb were feasible, it would be perfected and fabricated at a place to be chosen. In November 1942, the Manhattan District purchased the Los Alamos Ranch School for Boys, situated on a high mesa above the valley at Los Alamos, New Mexico. The few outsiders who knew about it called it simply Site Y. For friends and families of the personnel, it was just Post Office Box 1663. The work went on night and day. It was still a race against time. But the summer of 1945 arrived, and there was a sudden evacuation of the top scientific personnel from Los Alamos, but no one paid much attention to that. They were always coming and going. And then, on the morning of July 16, 1945, NBC News carried the story of people seeing a brilliant flash of light the night before out on the New Mexico desert. It was concluded that an ammunition dump must have exploded. But it was the test of the first atomic bomb at Alamogordo. The word was flashed to President Truman at Potsdam, Germany. He gave the order to use the new weapon. In a speech in Los Angeles last December 7th, Dr. Leo Szilard, now head of the Department of Physics at Brandeis University, explained why, in his opinion, Hitler never got the secret and why the Manhattan Project won the deadly race. He said many of the German scientists were sympathetic to the Nazis, but by 1939, all of them must have had their doubts. One of their number, Lisa Meitner, had been forced to flee Germany because of her Jewish inheritance. And Szilard added, "If doubts keep you from taking pleasure in certain ideas, those ideas won't come. And you're not likely to go around selling them to others as you must, if action is to follow thought." And Szilard concluded, "I believe this was not an accident at all. I believe that if you had lived among the Germans at that time and looked and listened sharply, you could have heard the mills of the gods grinding slowly and could have seen them grinding exceedingly fine." The Manhattan Project was many things: laboratories, complex installations, secrecy and security, and a spender of 2 billion precious dollars. But it was also people, scientists with ideas and with the freedom to talk about those ideas, sell them to others, even to the President of the United States. This is Chet Huntley in Los Angeles.
From the background of the scientific labors that brought forth the atomic age, there developed a new world struggle for balance of power. The old order was gone. It was a sharp new world led by the two new powers that grew out of the war, the United States on the west, the Soviet Union on the east. There followed a power struggle that brought us nearly 10 years of the Cold War, despite the formation of the United Nations. Moving both within and outside of the UN, the West formed its regional defense alignments as the Iron Curtain dropped over more Soviet satellite states. We responded with the Marshall Plan, the Truman Doctrine, and increased efforts in the UN. Through that body, the free world answered the call of communist aggression in Korea. That action, against the backdrop of an expanding Red China and the growing nationalism in other areas of the Far East, have brought Asia to a new role on the world stage, just a decade after the war in the Pacific. To assess that role, we call in Tokyo and NBC's Far Eastern News Chief, George Thomas Folster.
Until the end of the Pacific War, the Asiatics had little to say for themselves. Foreign powers spoke for the big Asian powers, except Japan, and the smaller Asian countries didn't count. These last 10 years has changed that situation. India's voice is now often and loudly heard and in important world-affecting conferences. The Prime Minister of Burma, Ono by name, has just finished a goodwill tour of the world and was received everywhere as an important statesman. China's future has become one of the world's greatest problems about which the world's two greatest powers continue to fight. The communists and their ideology have China sewed up now. But Western democracy continues to struggle to free the multi-millions of Chinese from red slavery. In these last 10 years, too many of these Asiatic nations have gained their complete independence. And whether some say this is good or bad, or whether we all like it or not, These new independent Asiatic nations have a voice of their own and are playing their own parts in world affairs. These teeming populations of Asia will industrialize their countries, are already well on their way. Japan, China, the Philippines are all manufacturing. So is India in this new Asiatic picture. And even the smaller jungle countries of Southeast Asia are avid to start factory wheels turning. But their rivers are unharnessed for the most part, and their powerhouses, if any, are far too expensive to operate. But atomic power plants can change all that and jump centuries. This is George Thomas Bolster in Tokyo.
From the Far Eastern picture as seen in Japan, the only nation thus far blasted by the A-bomb, let's get the European story on this nuclear decade, the British contribution to it, the Russian race for supremacy and the factors that aided them in that race. We call in London and Ed Newman.
As early as the spring of 1940, British scientists had told their government that an atomic bomb was possible. By the middle of 1941, a group of British and French research workers had established the feasibility of making a bomb with uranium-235. They also established the feasibility of getting explosions out of uranium-238 and plutonium. The British had made a great contribution on the theoretical side. They also helped with the practical. A team of physicists under Sir James Chadwick contributed to actual bomb development at Los Alamos. Another group of scientists under Sir John Cockcroft went to Chalk River, Ontario, to work on the heavy water pile, which provided a link between Britain and the United States. In those days, there was an agreement, as the British put it, for complete cooperation and sharing of results. That cooperation and sharing never took place. American law, embodied in the McMahon Act, ruled it out. American reluctance to share the bomb was accentuated by concern over British security. True, the United States had its own atomic spies, but the British had Burgess and McLean, the disappearing diplomats who vanished in the summer of 1951. They had Bruno Pontecorvo, the young Italian-born atomic scientist, who disappeared that same summer and has since turned up in Russia. They had Alan Nunn May, first of the atomic spies to be unmasked. And they had Dr. Klaus Fuchs, perhaps the most damaging and influential spy of all time. Today, the United States and Britain still go their separate ways in developing nuclear weapons. The British are even making their own hydrogen bomb. It may be exploded within a year if they can find a territory willing to let it be set off. Meanwhile, Russia has pretty well caught up. This is Ed Newman in London. To tell you about Russia, here is Romney Wheeler.
The Soviet Union is working night and day developing nuclear and thermonuclear weapons. The latest series of Russian tests disclosed last week is proof of that. But nobody except a handful of Russian scientists and a few high officials in the Kremlin knows how advanced these weapons may be. Certainly, the Russians have the atomic bomb, and probably various types of tactical weapons with atomic warheads. They've had the A-bomb for at least 6 years, due largely to the espionage of Nunn May, Fuchs, and the Rosenbergs. 2 years ago, in August 1953, they succeeded in detonating an experimental hydrogen bomb. It may not have been a true bomb, in the sense of being a weapon compact enough to be delivered by an intercontinental bomber or a rocket, but almost certainly it was a thermonuclear explosion. In the peaceful uses of atomic energy, the Russians recently have been more forthcoming. In London last week, at a conference of world scientists, they distributed 20 sets of a report, 5 volumes to the set, on Soviet research in this field. It claims that work on atomic energy was going on in Russia even before the end of World War II, and claims that Russia built the first atomic reactor in Europe. The Russians are pushing ahead with atomic power stations. Yuri Malenkov, then premier, announced in July of 54 that Russia's first atomic power plant had been commissioned. It had a capacity of 5,000 kilowatts. About 2 months ago, it was announced that a second atomic power station was under construction and would be completed ahead of those being built in Britain. Thus, Russia may be behind the West in some phases of nuclear research, but not far behind. In others, especially in experimental weapons, she may even be ahead.
NBC's Romney Wheeler, reporting from London on the European phases of our story, and leading us to the control aspect so necessary in the nuclear age ushered in by the A-bomb a decade ago. The point was stressed by Sir Winston Churchill, speaking in Boston in March of 1949.
It is certain that Europe would have been communized like Czechoslovakia and London under bombardment some time ago, but for the deterrent of the atomic bomb in the hands of the United States.
At this point, the control aspects of atomic energy were paramount in the minds of world leaders. For that phase of our story, we call in Washington and Richard Harkness.
This report goes back almost 6 years in this past atomic decade. White House reporters were called this day to the office of President Truman's news secretary. Joseph Short, who is dead now, was agitated. His face was white. His hands shook as he passed around single mimeographed sheets. There was no need for Short to comment. The statement spoke for itself. It was a terse announcement in the name of the President of the United States that Russia had created an atomic explosion. Now, that was September 23rd, 1949. We had lost that day in a single searing blast out in the Russian Ural Mountains our comfortable feeling monopoly on the atomic bomb. Well, shortly, again in the White House, a private meeting took place. On one side of the desk was Mr. Truman. Across from him was a senator, Senator Brian McMahon of Connecticut, chairman then of the Joint Congressional Atomic Energy Committee. Well, McMahon was then, and still ranks, although he's dead now, as our leading atomic statesman. For in 1946, McMahon and a group of atomic scientists had literally defeated the entire Pentagon. A Secretary of War, Robert Patterson, favored a bill at the time before Congress called the May-Johnson Bill. It was a measure which put control of the entire post-war atomic program in the hands of the military. McMahon and the scientists, notably Leo Szilard of the University of Chicago, disagreed. The subject of the atom was so complicated, as it was fearful in those days, but the public understood the issue of military control versus civilian control. At one point even, McMahon had his clerks count his mail. 7,972 letters for civilian control, 12 for military. So in 1946, the McMahon bill had passed Congress. President Truman had appointed our first civilian atomic energy commission. David Lilienthal of TVA was the first chairman. Now, sitting across from the president, McMahon was talking earnestly. The Russians, he said, were behind us in nuclear weapons. It's logical then, rather than just catching up to the United States, that the communists are trying to jump into the lead. Must we not go on the premise that when the Reds created that atomic explosion you announced, they set off the trigger for the hydrogen bomb? A McMahon's quiet logic prevailed. On January 31st of 1950, just midway in this atomic decade, President Truman announced to the world that the United States will concentrate on producing a hydrogen bomb. Thus, with a White House order, Mr. Truman silenced an argument within the Atomic Energy Commission. He ended a debate within the Atomic Advisory Committee. Since that date in 1951, atomic progress has been impressive and frightening. Now, this business of creating machines of nuclear death has cost the American public to date $12 billion. But our money has served so far to deter war, which makes our investment cheap. And today, there is new atomic work behind the barbed wire that guards atomic energy headquarters here on Constitution Avenue. The day is coming, and shortly, when the atom will be harnessed for peace. This is Richard Harkness, in Washington.
Our story of the atom, menace, and promise will be continued after a 10-second pause for station identification. As the nuclear age rolled ahead under the new Atomic Energy Commission, atomic power became a catchword. It was popularized in all manner of forms. They even had songs about it.
Atomic power! Atomic power!
But for the scientists, there was another vision that was flashed in the first successful A-bomb explosion. This, they were sure, was the spark that would fuse an even greater power force. Experiments on the superbomb moved to the testing stage, from the splitting of atoms in the A-bomb to the fusing or welding of hydrogen atoms. By 1953, they were ready with a superbomb that could be delivered on target, and it was exploded in the Pacific on March 1, 1954. The test island was destroyed. The bomb left a crater on the ocean floor beneath it. Radiation spread over an area wider than had been expected. Rumors flew, stories that the blast went out of control. AEC Chairman Louis Strauss himself laid those rumors and fears to rest.
The first one has been variously characterized as devastating and out of control. I would not wish to minimize it. It was a stupendous blast in the megaton range, but at no time was the testing out of control.
However, at the moment of the March 1st blast, a Japanese fishing vessel, the Fortunate Dragon, happened to be within 70 miles of the testing ground. NBC's John Rich, in that Pacific area at the time, tells what happened.
A cloud formed on the horizon. It grew larger and finally showered the deck with a powdery ash. These ashes turned the deck white, coated the hands, the heads, the necks of the fishermen. One man actually scraped up some of the dust, put it in a matchbox, and kept it under his pillow all the way home.
Subsequently, one of the fishermen did die, although it's never been certain that his death was due to the radiation. But the communists made propaganda capital of the incident to stir up anti-American feeling. And various reports on effects of the superbomb's radiation fallout went round the world to stir up fears and contribute to world insecurity. Early this year, Chairman Strauss again spoke out in reassurance.
In general, the total amount of radiation received by residents of the United States from all nuclear detonations to date, including the Russian and the British tests, and all of our own tests in the United States and the Pacific, has been about 1/10 of one rentgen. This is only about 1/100 of the average radiation exposure inevitably received from natural causes by any person during his or her reproductive lifetime.
Yet the terrible power of this super bomb of hydrogen is more frightening than all of the diversified weapons of the atomic family that have now been developed. These range from small or tactical bombs to the strategic bombs that are 25 times more powerful than the device last exploded in warfare over Nagasaki 10 years ago today.
In the first decade of the nuclear age, there is no doubt that the atom has been more of a menace than a promise.
Hanson W. Baldwin, military affairs editor of the New York Times.
The military uses of nuclear power have been far more important to date than the peaceful applications. It is true that we're opening a second decade during which nuclear power developments will assume tremendous importance. We have just started what might be termed a revolution in power. But in the immediate future, the principal uses to which atomic power will be harnessed will be military ones. Atomic engines for submarines and surface men of war, nuclear-powered military aircraft, small, portable nuclear power plants for the Army engineers. Let's see what influence the atom has had to date on the military art. I would like first to discuss nuclear weapons, second, their influence upon tactics, and finally, upon strategy. Now, any capsule summary of atomic weapons development would stress the tremendous increase in both numbers and types of nuclear weapons since Hiroshima. The United States had one type of weapon 10 years ago, a bomb with power equivalent to about 20,000 tons of TNT. And we had, at the end of the war, only about three of them. Today, our stockpile of nuclear weapons is numbered in the thousands, probably between 5,000 and 10,000. We are manufacturing so-called thermonuclear or hydrogen weapons, each of which has an explosive equivalent to several million tons of TNT. We have a whole family of nuclear weapons for use against troops, planes, ships, or cities. There are atomic depth charges, which when detonated deep beneath the sea, will crush like an eggshell any submarine within many square miles. There are so-called tactical A weapons, which can be delivered by single-seater fighter bombers. And there are city busters, carried by heavy bombers. It is an old axiom of the military art that weapons make tactics. Thus, nuclear arms and corresponding developments in missiles, aircraft, and so on are altering profoundly tactics or the art of applying force to the battlefield. In the air, the mass bombing formations of World War II are gone. Today, one plane can deliver more destructive power than all our bombers of World War II put together. On the ground, our Army has today at least three different means of delivering nuclear weapons against an enemy. The so-called 280-millimeter atomic cannon, the Honest John artillery rocket, the Corporal guided missile. The threat of nuclear attack has forced the ground forces to emphasize dispersion, concealment, and cover. Tactics at sea in the nuclear age also emphasize dispersion, speed, cover, and mobility. Fleet cruising dispositions are far more dispersed than they used to be. Amphibious attacks are not ended, but profoundly changed. Helicopters will supplement and may in time replace landing craft for ship-to-shore movements. The submarine, particularly the nuclear submarine, which can stay underwater indefinitely, has a new importance because its ability to conceal itself in the broad wastes of ocean give it greater protection than surface ships against nuclear attack. The influence of the atom upon strategy has been even more profound. It has increased the world's insecurity. The United States, for the first time since the Indian Wars, has live frontiers of the sea and the sky, vulnerable to assault. Jet planes, guided missiles, and the awful power of nuclear weapons have destroyed our continental isolation. The civilian, even more than the soldier, is threatened with attack. The trend is toward the nation in arms. We need time and warning, so we have had to extend our first line of defense far beyond our coasts. In a strategic sense, the cynical jest of a century ago that the military, if given their head, would want bases on the moon to protect themselves against an invasion from Mars has almost come true. With an Earth satellite now in prospect, with intercontinental ballistic missiles scheduled for the next decade, the meaning of oceans, mountains, and terrain barriers has far less strategic importance than in the past. We are truly becoming one world in a strategic sense, if not in a political one.
The speed of modern research is evident here, and in 10 short years since their first use against Japan, atomic weapons are already classified as conventional. As we've moved on to more awesome weapons of the thermonuclear variety, the frightful potential of the hydrogen bomb in war today underscores the fears of the world. Twice recently, in connection with those fears, groups of eminent scientists have appealed to the nations to end war, because they believe the hydrogen bomb threatens the continued existence of mankind. In announcing the appeal, British mathematician and philosopher Bertrand Russell revealed that the late Albert Einstein subscribed to the appeal in a letter that reached London the day the physicist died on April 18th. Lord Russell himself has been leading the move to ban war for a long time.
Shall we put an end to the human race, or shall mankind renounce war? People will not face this alternative because it is so difficult to abolish war. But what perhaps impedes understanding of the situation more than anything else is that the term mankind feels vague and abstract. People scarcely realize in imagination that the danger is to themselves and their children and their grandchildren, and not only to a dimly apprehended humanity. And so they hope that perhaps war may be allowed to continue, provided modern weapons are prohibited. I'm afraid this hope is illusory. Whatever agreements not to use H-bombs had been reached in time of peace, they would no longer be considered binding in time of war. I appeal as a human being to human beings. Remember your humanity and forget the rest. If you can do so, the way lies open to a new paradise. If you cannot, nothing lies before you but universal death.
Words of warning to the world from Bertrand Russell. Well aware of the menace, the United Nations tackles the armaments race in another way. Here is NBC's UN correspondent, Pauline Frederick.
The light, brighter than the sun which burned Hiroshima, also illuminated the dark recesses of human thinking. Up to that time, war had been accepted as the normal behavior of nations. With the lurid dawn of the atomic age, a new revelation was to come to man. As President Eisenhower put it in his report to the nation on the meeting at the summit, there seems to be a growing realization by all that nuclear warfare pursued to the ultimate could be practically race suicide. The pre-atomic United Nations Charter recognized this atomic fact in its purpose to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. But it was to be 10 years before the full import of this responsibility was grasped, so that a dedication on paper would begin to motivate human action. When the UN Disarmament Subcommittee meets here in New York on August 29th, by directive from the summit, it will be animated more than any disarmament meeting since the end of World War II by one purpose. That is, to try to prevent another Hiroshima. The subcommittee will convene in an atmosphere very different from the pall of deadlock which has hung over previous disarmament sessions. Gone are the days when the United States, holding a monopoly on the atomic bomb, could insist that all conventional forces must be cut in proportion to each nation's strength. This would have leveled off superior Soviet land power. Gone are the days when the Soviet Union could demand abolition of the atomic bomb first, and then across-the-board reduction in conventional forces. This would have retained superior Soviet land power. Gone are the days when each side could indulge in the luxury of immovable positions and easy accusations of bad faith and propaganda. The United States and Russia are now reaching a dead heat in the nuclear arms race, and a world sick from anxiety lest this lead to suicide is demanding freedom from such fear. And so when the Disarmament Subcommittee convenes on August 29th, it will be, according to both President Eisenhower and Premier Bulgarin, to try to find agreement. Both men have said their delegations will carefully study the proposals of the other. President Eisenhower's plan for an exchange of military blueprints and mutual aerial reconnaissance of military installations. The Soviet plan for gradual steps toward reduction of conventional arms and forces and eventual abolition of nuclear weapons and the policing of military concentrations to make sure disarmament agreements are observed. But each side is aware that disarmament will not flow from a formula on paper. First, there must be a restoration of confidence in the purposes and objectives of each. For where there is a will to conflict, a way can usually be found regardless of treaty pledges or restraints which an international inspection system might seek to impose. Therefore, as the disarmament experts prepare to renew their work on plans for checking the arms race and devising a system for warning the world of violations, the political leaders continue their efforts begun on the summit. That is, to break down the barriers of misunderstanding and fear that create armament. To the extent that these latter succeed, real disarmament will be possible, and mankind will be able to turn a confident face toward the sun, knowing that in the harnessing of its power, there is life, not death. This is Pauline Frederick.
There's another phase of our story of atomic energy for peace growing out of the UN effort and the proposals of President Eisenhower. In Geneva, 72 nations are represented at the International Conference on the Peaceful Uses of the Atom. To report on the meetings, we switch to Geneva and Frank Burkholzer.
This is a conference with overtones, and the big overtone is the competition between Russia and America. Perhaps the international press is manufacturing more competition than exists, as some of the scientists have told me, but on the other hand, it's difficult to imagine a more fierce competition than that which does exist between these two nations, and it cannot be kept out of the proceedings here. So a scientist has to consider the interests of his team. He must be careful not to give away the signals of his quarterback to the other side. This is a restrictive influence on the conference, but it does add a touch of drama. The Americans have so far dominated the technical scene here, but the Russians have been impressive. The Russians have brought in a lot of high-grade exhibits. It's true that Americans who know nucleonics have taken me personally around the Russian exhibit and have shown me piece by piece that American stuff is at least a little better in every case. But they also say the Russian stuff is still very, very good. And what's more, it's obviously equipment that comes from a production line. They obviously have a big, big industry behind it. And that's the real significance, because Russia's atomic industry is big and booming. Industrial scientists are awaiting an American announcement on the subject of the possibilities of harnessing the hydrogen bomb to peaceful or benign use, as the Atomic Energy Commission calls it. This touchy subject was opened up at the Geneva Conference by its president, Dr. Baba of India. Just why, no one knows, but a large number of persons seems to be awfully happy that he did. And these persons include American industry representatives. They won't be quoted directly, but for guidance, they tell me this. If it is possible to tame the hydrogen bomb to useful power production, then the systems being discussed at this Geneva conference are obsolete, because as plentiful as uranium and thorium seem to be becoming, they are rare metals compared with the fuel that goes into a hydrogen bomb. For a fusion reactor, the fuel cost would be tiny. The cost would be small, and the availability would be virtually unlimited. Now, there seems to be a strong suspicion that the American government has something that it can say about this subject, that there have been results from experiments, results the American atomic business community would like to know about, simply because millions of dollars of investment depend on the results of these experiments. And the businessman is a fellow who doesn't like to be surprised where his investments are involved. In the days to come, this conference will become embroiled on one topic that is sure to overbalance everything else, at least for a few days. The question of whether our future in atomic development is a danger to our future as human beings. Opinions on this subject are divided, and the temperature of discussion seems bound to rise among these men who are likely to be in charge of our future on both scores. This is Frank Burgholzer in Geneva.
Our special report on an international conference that's giving new emphasis to non-military aspects of atomic energy and new point to President Eisenhower's proposals on atoms for peace. Now, another look into the future of the nuclear age that's just beginning its second decade by the author of the well-known book, Atoms for Peace, David O. Woodbury and the Promise of the Peacetime Atom.
All important discoveries bring danger and responsibility along with their service to mankind, but none has ever thrown such a brilliant and startling light over the world as this one. The atom is for all of us, and we could all be destroyed if we sat on the sidelines in abject fear and waited. I don't think we will do that. There is too much of the pioneering spirit in us, and the opportunities for good in the peaceful atom are too numerous to be ignored. We Americans love sensation. We delight in the dramatic. The bomb has been the greatest sensation of all time. Spectacular, frightening, perpetually news. But the peaceful atom won't be like that. It means work. It will demand the best from all of us. There is much good, solid thinking to be done outside the laboratories. It is the kind of thinking a whole people has to do in order to run its own lives, the kind that determines the great trends in our social and economic life. The atom is for everybody, inescapable, vital, a turning point in human affairs. War released a new and towering giant, which peace must tame. So great are the problems of the atom's incredible power that scientists and statesmen alone cannot cope with them. The nations most likely to survive are those which have accepted these problems, facing them candidly as a whole people. To me, the message of the atomic age is a challenge as well as a promise. A challenge to understand, to get excited, to become active, in however small a way, in the vast prospects of the new day. Let's get it straight. The atom may bring utopia, but it will not be that fancy push-button dream of the lazy and the indolent. The utopia that lies ahead for us is a new world of action, improvement, progress, the steadily increasing opportunity to realize human capacities. Think back for a minute. Did a lazy man's utopia follow the invention of the automobile, the telephone, the radio, TV? It did not. Each of these great inventions opened up our country and the world, making every man a neighbor to every other. In the old horse and buggy days, millions were confined to their own homes and their own towns, to Today, they are citizens of the world. Their lives are fuller, happier, more exciting. Their contributions are exchanged around the globe. That is what awaits us again in the dawning age of the peaceful atom, a life tremendously accelerated and made more useful because so many more of man's hidden talents will be released, so many of his aspirations will come true. For example, there will be more food because the atom can help to raise it in quantities and qualities never dreamed of before. Hundreds of millions now existing on the borderline of starvation will be well fed. Their vigor will return. They will produce more of the good things of life for themselves and for others all over the earth. There will be more health for everyone because the atom can and will work toward the conquest of ill health. For 10 years now, it has been tackling the complicated problems of keeping the human body in fine working trim. Already it has chalked up important victories in the battle against cancer and heart disease. More victories come to light every day. There has never been so powerful a weapon in the long conquest of disease. Most important of all, perhaps, the taming of the atom has taught us to think and to act more resolutely and more clearly. We have learned to bring new and swifter forces to bear upon all the problems of humanity. Because of the challenge of atomic energy, we have invented the mass attack method against disease. Not single workers in isolated laboratories now, but thousands organized into great coordinated teams pushed side by side toward the goal. This task force method can be used in anything, all possible forces combined for the common good. What does it all mean? Two things: a fuller, happier, more useful life for those of us in middle passage, and a wonderful and ever-expanding opportunity for young people everywhere. Today, only a few percent of our youth look toward the atom as a career. Tomorrow, tens of thousands will be engaged, not only on the technical side, but in the arts, in medicine, in law, in business, in the factories, and on the farms. There is no limit to the opportunities the atom can make. Never has there been such a dawn or such a challenge. Menace or promise, it depends entirely on us.
David O. Woodbury pointing the way to our future in the nuclear age and reminding us of General Grove's statement that the menace and the promise of the atom go together. The nuclear weapons that could bring universal destruction and that contribute to world insecurity in that threat are in themselves a kind of insurance against that destruction. For the potential terror inherent in these weapons is so great that fear of reprisal in kind gives pause to any aggressor who would explode the globe in nuclear war. Nevertheless, the world is insecure and fearful. So the balancing goal is to ease those fears, the insecurity and the mistrust. The United States took a step in that direction recently at Geneva, where for the first time since the Cold War started, there was trust enough created on which to arrange negotiations. And for the first time, too, Soviet leaders heard President Eisenhower personally stress his basic idea that nothing is more important than peace, not even the issues that divide East and West. As he puts it, there can be no alternative to peace in the menace of nuclear and thermonuclear weapons. Yet in the scientific advances that create these weapons and their menace lies the promise of the atomic age, a promise of the greatest, richest future yet envisioned for this spinning globe and for all of mankind. Been listening to The Atom, Menace and Promise, a specially transcribed program of NBC News, produced under the supervision of Samuel M. Sharkey, Jr., edited and narrated by Arthur Wakely. Special statements recorded for this program were contributed by Lieutenant General Leslie R. Groves, Hanson W. Baldwin, and David O. Woodbury. This is Jack Costello speaking. Monitor takes you everywhere each weekend on NBC Radio.
This is Bill Henry with the news. Residents of the Atlantic Coast states are torn between delight at the suddenly better weather after the long siege of blazing summer heat and the ominous threat posed by Connie, the season's first tropical hurricane. The threat is so serious that the entire Atlantic coast, remembering last year's three howling hurricanes, is now under an alert. Military planes have been flown inland, ships have put to sea to ride out the storm, residents of flimsy summer cottages along the coast have been warned, and enormous seas are already pounding the beaches from the North Carolina capes up to New Jersey. Weathermen who are following the course of the storm note that it is following the exact path taken by the three destructive blows of a year ago. And while it may veer out to sea, as most hurricanes do, it will, if it holds its present speed and follows its present course, strike the Carolina and Virginia shore full blast sometime tomorrow morning. New England, which may feel the belated fury of the blast, is already in the grips of another sort of trouble, as mysterious and unpredictable as tropical storms. This is the plague of polio, which has seized Massachusetts in particular in its grip and is approaching the epidemic stage. Everything that science can do to meet the threat is being done, and just today the government released another million Salk anti-polio shots for distribution in danger areas. Elsewhere, while the world's atomic scientists over in Geneva were exchanging information on the peaceful uses of the atom and predicting atomic power as cheap as that produced by coal within the next 20 years, the citizens